everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. Hope everyone had a good past few days. This is E. Marcel Portut. Hope everyone's doing well out there. Going to do a little quick podcast for you, recapping everything that happened over the weekend, including events in the NBA, UFC, some NASCAR, auto racing, and other activities as well. So we're going to dig into it, and I'm going to end the show on a segment about why Dennis Rodman and his recent visits to North Korea are ruffling my feathers here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Handful of games in the NBA that I want to hit on that took place this weekend. First of all, and actually we'll hit up all the events that took place on Sunday. The first game that I saw of interest was the Miami and Knicks game. And actually, I'm going to take this on a different level. I'm going to switch it up a little bit. If you listen to my past few podcasts, we've talked about the good teams and the bad teams and my power rankings. And I'll have a power rankings out probably by the end of the week, you know, as far as how all the NBA teams are doing right now. But what I saw on Sunday, yesterday, was really the demarcation or the breakdown of three levels of NBA teams. You saw teams that are good, very good, and truly elite. And actually, the teams that I thought were very good, and you saw them in the last game on Sunday, at least for our national stage on ESPN, was Indiana and Chicago. Both of them are good teams. The Bulls, I think, still have the best defense in all of the NBA. You look at the statistics and the overall analysis, I think you agree with that. Noah and Deng have produced all-star seasons. But the missing piece of Derrick Rose prevents them from becoming a truly very good or even elite team. And that's what you saw in their loss to Indiana, where all the players were playing hard and they played excellent defense, yet they lacked the points to really produce that victory. And then you look on the other side with Indiana, who finally got Danny Granger back for the first time this season. And they had him come off the bench. He played a few minutes, missed all of his field goal attempts. They're working him back into shape. But you look at Indiana, who I still think are the biggest threat to the Heat in the East. You have David West, Roy Hibbert, Paul George, who's emerged as an all-star player as well. You have those three players who not only are physical inside, but can actually, especially on the George side of things, create their own shots. And then we get Lance Stephenson coming off the bench as well. He brings some toughness, and their entire roster. And if Granger can come back and become a 20-point scorer, they're really going to become a dangerous team in the East. And that was a really good win for them over the Bulls last night. But you still saw that they lacked a little bit of something, you know, as well, to reach that higher level. They're going to be playoff teams. They may even win a series. But if they're going to get beyond the conference finals and maybe make an NBA finals appearance, they still have a little bit more work to do. Then you look at teams that are very good. I put the New York Knicks and Los Angeles Clippers, the two teams that lost yesterday, in that category. And let's look at the Knicks game first. They lost to Miami. When you look at the Knicks, you see a lot of good qualities. You have Carmelo Anthony, one of the top scorers in the league. He's playing at an all-NBA first-team type level. You have Tyson Chandler, who is solid defensively. Amari Stoudemire, he's become actually a really good asset, you know, off the bench. Gives him some bench scoring. You have Novak and J.R. Smith, guys who can make a lot of jumpers at the right times and can carry your offense for a quarter. And they've actually achieved a lot of victories by shooting a lot of three-pointers, making a decent amount of them, being efficient on the offensive side, not turning the ball over, and playing respectable defense. And despite all of the head-wringing and the negativity you'll read in the media about the Knicks, their jump-shooting team, and how they have so many flaws, they still have the second-best record in the East behind the Heat. And I think you saw in that contest, you saw why the Knicks, at times, the Knicks before yesterday had beaten Miami the two previous times by 20 or more points each of those contests. And you saw how they could achieve that. The Knicks had some solid runs in the second and third quarter. However, in the end, you saw Miami, and we'll get to the Heat later on and why they're truly an elite team. But you saw just the differentiation between the Heat and the Knicks and the Pacers as well, and even the Bulls. And you're seeing why the Heat are the supreme favorite to win the Eastern Conference, unless something drastically happens with one of the core players from Miami. And let's look at the other side, the other game, the Oklahoma City and Clippers game. And I've been touting Chris Paul to be MVP for the majority of the season. I think you all know who's going to get the award, and we'll get to his team in a minute or so. But I think Paul has definitely been the best point guard in the NBA this season. And you also have Blake Griffin, who's improved his game. They still have, the Clippers have the best bench in the league. When you can bring out Bledsoe and Jamal Crawford and Lamar Odom, you know, into the fray, and even Grant Hill making contributions, when you can do that, they have two units that can score and have, they have command of who should score, who's a distributor, who's a defensive presence. DeAndre Jordan as well has improved his defense and gives you some solid shot blocking. But the thing about the Clippers, I think they have too many good players, but not a truly great player. I think Chris Paul is a great player, and is going to, and as I said, is a MVP candidate. But the rotation is just too much. They need to cut that rotation down to a few guys, and especially on the back, in the backcourt side of things, between the shooting guards and the point guards. Because if you look at it, they have Paul, they have Chauncey Billups, they have Jamal Crawford, they have Bledsoe. You can even throw a Grant Hill out there. Those are five guys right there. Not even, and Matt Barnes as well, who I guess they're, Barnes and Odom are definitely more forwards. But you look at those five or six guys, that's just in the backcourt. There's too many people in there. And I think it'll be tough to tell Billups to sit down and, you know, and to take a back seat to Crawford and Bledsoe, which is something I would do. So that team, they just, I think they have too many guys in the rotation, which is kind of odd to say because you think they have a lot of guys that make them a better team overall. But I think it messes with the flow and the chemistry of the team. And they're a very good team. I know Tony Parker's hurt, and Tony Parker will be on the next topic after I talk about Miami and Oklahoma City. So the Spurs are still right there as well, but they didn't have a national TV game last night like those other six teams did. So I think the Clippers are going to be right there with the Clippers, the Spurs, and the Thunder. Two of those three teams will be in the conference finals, and they'll work that out. And as far as the truly elite teams, you look at Miami. LeBron James is, when he doesn't get 38-8, you know, on his stat line, you're disappointed by that. You know, he's the best player in the league, best player in the world, going to win his fourth MVP by the end of this season. And you saw where, and really I'll take it back a little bit as well, you saw the game on his Friday night game when he really struggled throughout the contest and missed a lot of his shots, only had 4 points through three quarters. But then he scored 14 in the fourth quarter and got the Miami Heat the win. And that's where you're starting to see the maturity of his game. It's not just about scoring points with them. You see the defensive presence, that the final dunk to close the game. You saw a telegraph pass by the Knicks. He picked it off at half court, dunked it in. He's the first team all-defensive player. So the Heat, for 14 games in a row, they're going to try to keep that going for the next few games. And Miami is truly an elite team where you have James, you have Wade, Chris Bosh, he makes those outside shots, and he really stretches the defense. Even in Chalmers, I've been riding him hard a little bit too, but he's had a decent run as well. And you look at their bench, it's not a great bench. I mean, unfortunately, they're so front-loaded in the starting lineup with their big three. You have to have guys like Joel Anthony and Chris Anderson, Birdman, actually coming off the bench for them. And that's where they actually struggle, is the front court. If it's a running up and down contest, you get Norris Cole in there as well. Like how the Knicks kind of try to play him. The Heat are going to win 99% of those games. And you're not going to beat them 4 times out of 7 in a 2-week span of a playoff series. So what you have to do is become physical with them, control the pace of the game, and that's where Indiana and Chicago, they excel at those things. But last night, you saw the Heat really just continue their flow as well. And then you look at Oklahoma City. I still don't like Westbrook's usage rate. And, I mean, I've seen the statisticians, you know, make their cases where his usage rate is the highest of any player in the NBA. You know, yet they're still a decently efficient offense for the Thunder. I think that's going to hurt them in the end. But for the regular season, when teams don't have much time to prepare, you know, that works out very well. Kevin Durant, he can average 30 to 35 points a game per contest if he wanted. And he continued to show his skills as well. And I think Ibaka has been a really solid contributor for them as well, becoming that third scorer. We know Ibaka brings excellent defense, good shot blocker, but he's starting to make his outside shots, and that's been really good. And I like Kevin Martin as well. That's why I really wasn't too concerned about the trade with James Harden. Obviously, James Harden's a better player than Kevin Martin, absolutely, and Harden's proven himself with the Rockets. But when you look at the structure of the Thunder as a team, I want to say Harden's not needed to become for the Thunder to reach the finals and eventually win the championship. But I think if you have Westbrook and Durant controlling the pace of the game, and you have Martin coming off the bench giving that second unit some scoring, that should be enough. And they'll figure it out in the end how they're going to have the back. And they're a crunch time lineup. You're going to have Martin and Westbrook in the same backcourt, and with Durant, probably Ibaka, and I guess you could have Perkins in there or Cephalosha, but they'll figure all that stuff out. I just think they have enough players to make a run in the Western Conference and make it back to the finals with the current roster. So those are some things I saw on Sunday's game. Also, Tony Parker is out for a month. He has severely sprained ankle, so he is going to be out for a little while. The Spurs are still a very good team without him. I think they're 4-1 this season when he does not play. My boy Patty Mills from St. Mary's, Australian, he's going to get some run at the point, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that. However, I think this month off actually might be a good thing. Sure, it takes Tony Parker out of the MVP candidacy, and if you're looking at All-NBA first team, he's not going to make that now, missing a substantial amount of games. But the thing about the Spurs is all about rest and continuity. It's all about the rest because they do have some older players on the roster, mainly Parker, 30-year-old point guard, Ginobili, and Tim Duncan. So you need the rest. However, the way that the Spurs run, they have such a unit that goes on continuity, and they just replace the parts and put it in there. Obviously, they're going to drop some games that they normally wouldn't without Parker, of course. But I think for the month off that he's going to get rehabbing the ankle and just resting his knees and other his body parts, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world that he's out for a month. Now, if his ankle doesn't recover and there's something more serious, obviously that's an issue. But he's gonna sit out some games anyway, the way the Spurs operate. So I didn't think that was a big issue overall. I saw some of the Atlanta game against the Lakers being here in Atlanta. Obviously, the Hawks are the hometown team that I follow. I don't like the road losses to the Suns and the Lakers. And this is why the Hawks are such an enigma as far as where they are as a franchise. You look at the roster, obviously the Josh Smith issue is the biggest one. Do they keep him or does he leave? They decided at the trade deadline to keep him, and that's been some mixed results. Overall, he's actually had a pretty decent year overall. But you look at the Hawks, they just need a complete overhaul or a revamping. I like Al Horford. He's a solid player. Jeff Teague, I think, could be a decent point guard. I don't know if he's a top 10 point guard in the NBA, but he's serviceable. And then you look at the rest of the roster, it's a bunch of guys that actually, they're not going to be there within a year or two. They're going to have, I think, only 4 players under contract. And that includes Josh Smith because he's a free agent, unrestricted free agent at the end of the season. He can go anywhere he wants. They only have 4 players on the contract for this upcoming season or in the offseason. So they can really revamp the roster. And I look at this as the Hawks going to be probably a 5 or 6 seed. They may give a team like Brooklyn some trouble, you know, as far as, or even a Chicago. They might give them a little bit of trouble in the first round. If they get Brooklyn, I would not be surprised to see them actually beat Brooklyn in that playoff series. I'm not as bullish on the Nets as their record would indicate, you know, but I think that the Hawks, just looking at some of those games closely, I didn't see too much of the Suns game, but you have to win that game if you have any, you want to get a good seed in the postseason. I saw some of the Lakers game. You know, the Lakers finally back to 500. They're starting to get it together. It's interesting with them. I've been saying for months, or really for the past month or so, since we've been doing the podcast, that the Lakers are not going to make the playoffs. But if you look who are ahead of them, there's some teams that I definitely could see getting in a really bad losing streak, including I've been a Warriors follower, or I like their style of play, but they've had some definite losses that are disappointing. They've lost their last 4 games. They lost at Philly, Boston, New York, and Indiana to end their road trip, and they're only about 4 or 5 games ahead of the Lakers. So if the Lakers get Gasol back and they figure some things out, there's a possibility that the Lakers can catch the Warriors and really make an impact there. And then the Rockets are the 8th seed as well. And the Rockets are such an up-and-down team. They can score a lot of points, but they give them up as well. So I think the Lakers, I was watching how their setup is. I'd still say they're not going to make the playoffs, but if they make a postseason run, or make a late run in the regular season to make the postseason, I could definitely see them having an impact as well. Just 2 last thoughts. Andrew Bynum in Philadelphia. I feel so bad for the Philadelphia fans. They made the Iguodala trade. They got rid of some other players and they brought back Bynum. And if you look at their makeup of their roster, from Holiday to Evan Turner and some, you know, their group, all they need is that big man. They built their team around Bynum. I guess what they're trying to do is make the trades and get Bynum in Philadelphia for 1 year. And then he'd re-sign a long-term extension and become a part of the franchise for the next 5 to 10 years or beyond. And the problem has been, Bynum, he had another setback with his knee, so he might have to get season-ending surgery. Matter of fact, by the time I finish this podcast and post it, they may announce he has to get that surgery and he's done for the season. And that's really a big blow for them because they are not a playoff team right now. I talked in my last podcast about Doug Collins. He had that big rant after they lost their 6th straight game to the Magic a few nights ago, and just his disappointment with their effort. It just looks like a franchise that is really in a struggle right now, and it's tough for Bynum and for Philadelphia, because for Bynum himself, I really hope it's not a major injury for his sake and his career, and that he's just not trying to jake it or just trying to save himself for the offseason. If he can play, he really needs to get a few games under his belt, 10 or 15, just to show that he's not damaged goods, because he's an unrestricted free agent at the end of the year. And if I'm a major player or a major team like a Dallas or Houston or Orlando, Atlanta even, teams that are going to have some major cap space for next season, I'd be very, and the Sixers as well, I'd be very, very leery of signing him to a long-term deal. Just on the fact that he has an injury past, we all know the off the court and just the attitude is maybe not the best at times. And then you couple that with bad knees and bad legs, that's a major problem. And he has not even stepped on the court once this year. And that's something you have to be very concerned about for his side of things. And as far as the 76ers, you made that trade and it's going to be tough just to see him walk away. You rehabbed him. You know him intimately as far as getting him within your roster. And they're just going to let him walk away at the end of the season. That's going to be very difficult to do for the 76ers. And it seems like they have, as a franchise, they need to make that move. They're a major franchise. It's not about money. It's just they're in a tough spot. And you would think that the Sixers could attract some major players as far as the offseason goes. But they've had Bynum in there, and it just would be tough for them just to let him go without him even suiting up for them in a regular season game. And then finally, we got to contract the Charlotte Bobcats. And I mean, we all are Michael Jordan fans and watched him play and think he's the greatest ever. But as an executive, this is embarrassing to have your team play like this. They lost their game at Sacramento on Saturday, 119-83. That's not even a contest. It gets worse, everybody. They actually were behind by 43 points during that contest. And just to pull some stats out for y'all, according to Elias Sports Bureau, the ones that keep all the statistics going back since the infancy of the game, they fell behind by as many as 43 points in their 119-83 loss to the Kings. It's the fifth time in the last two seasons that Charlotte has trailed by at least 40 points in a game. Five times they've done that. No other NBA team has faced that deficit, 40 points in a contest, more than twice over that period. So they've done it five times. So let's recap their last 2 years. They've that mark before falling behind by 40 or more points five times in the past 2 years. They had that long losing streak that reached, I think, 20-plus games. They've had another losing streak, I think including in this season, that was like 10, 15 games plus. They may have the worst roster in the NBA. Kemba Walker, he has his moments. He's okay. I think Michael Kidd-Gilchrist can be a solid player later on for them. But you put all of that together, and it's just an embarrassment for a city that actually would support a decent team. If you remember back to the days with the Charlotte Hornets, when they had Alonzo Mourning, Muggsy Bogues, Larry Johnson, they had Curry, Adele Curry. They actually had some decent followings. And even when Glenn Rice was with them, they had a sellout crowd. It's a really good basketball market in Charlotte. But the ineptitude of that franchise is appalling. And as I said, they're not going to be contracted. And you can't change ownership. You can change the coach, the GM, trade a few players. But just that franchise overall has been in complete disappointment. And when you lose by that much to Sacramento, who they're a terrible team as well, that they really have to reevaluate what they're doing as a franchise. And I'm pretty sure that they have a first-year coach and a first-year GM. And I like the GM and the coach. Don't really know too much about him. He was interim coach at St. John's when Steve Lavin was going through his health troubles last year. So you look at all that together, and it's just a franchise that's in disarray. So while we talk about the good teams and the elite teams and the very good and break down all that stuff, I just wanted to talk about a bad team as well, because for all the good teams that are in the league, there are just as equal amount or maybe even more bad teams. So those are my NBA thoughts for you. Here on the Sports Wire podcast, we take a little bit of a break here, and when I come back, I'm going to talk about the latest UFC on Fuel event that took place in Japan on Saturday here on the Sports Inquirer Network. You know, it's interesting with the last UFC on Fuel event that here in the Portuit household, we don't get the Fuel channel. So, and it's funny, and actually this ties into probably a bigger sports issue that I've noticed, lately. It ties into Big Ten Network or Fox Soccer Channel. You could tie it into anything as far as your sports cable packages. Down here in Atlanta, I actually have a Comcast package. And for those of you unfamiliar with the situation, Fuel TV, the Fuel channel, which is part of the Fox family, which as far as Fox and FX and all that stuff, the Fuel channel, or Fuel TV, is actually not in the Comcast package here in Georgia, if you have it. So they actually made a change to, I think, the past few weeks. They're going to start offering it, and I actually need to check my box and make sure that's all set up and everything. So for the first time in a long time, I actually did not see a UFC event live. I actually had to find my sources pretty much on the internet to find out, to watch the fights. I knew who won because I had to go to my websites to see who actually won the fights. But I actually watched them Sunday morning and saw the recap, the full fights. I was happy for Wanderlei Silva getting that win, or Wanderlei. I was happy for him to get that win. The guy is MMA legend. Probably if he made a list of top 10 all-time fighters in MMA, he'd crack my list probably. Definitely top 15. The guy's been fighting since the mid to late 90s. So many great memories from him fighting in Pride Championships over in Japan. And I actually thought when this fight was announced, him against Brian Stann, Silva struggled. He's lost in four of his last, going into Saturday, he lost four of his last seven fights, some by some vicious knockouts. He's an older fighter who's actually in his mid-30s, which is not old per se, but if you've seen his fighting style, his fights against Crow Cop, Rampage Jackson, and etc., he's been in some wars. You know, so his body is broken down, but he comes to swing, he comes to fight. If you're a neutral fan, he's one of your favorite fighters ever. And I think what I'm going to start doing for my next few podcasts is kind of do a retrospective on some of the older MMA fighters and kind of their career highlights. Maybe even recommend some YouTube videos for you to see them in action. Because we all know about the Anderson Silvas, George St. Pierre, John Jones, and so forth. But there's a whole generation of guys before that who are slowly starting to retire and starting to see their few days kind of dwindle down. You've seen Matt Hughes retired in the past few months. And then that same generation of Wanderlei Silva, Rampage Jackson, and so forth. Older guys who you're starting to see kind of, you know, settle down as far as fighting in the cage. But I was happy to see him get that win. Stann, he brought it as well. Both guys came swinging. I thought that Stann actually had some good moments. He had some low blows, and I'm surprised it did not take a point from Stann. But after that second low blow in the second round, the first one kind of looked like it was going for a knee to the body, and his foot kind of grazed Silva's crotch area. But that second one looked a little more vicious there. Obviously, I don't think he was intentionally trying to kick him in the lower body in that area. But it looked a little more aggressive, and I'm surprised that the ref didn't take a point away there, because that was a second time. You assume the first low blow, you get the warning, and then the second one is when you actually get that point taken away. Besides that, Silva got the TKO, got the knockout, and I said he's had a lot of great moments in that arena in Japan, you know, so he got that win. So that was really good for him. I don't know what they're going to do beyond that. I've seen the Forrest Griffin name thrown out for Silva. It's tough to match him up because he's not a title contender, even though you never know. He might have a Randy Couture second or third gear in his career, but I don't see him being a title contender, yet he's such a big name, you don't want to put him in against a nobody. So Forrest Griffin kind of fits that category of guys kind of at the equal stages of their career. Brian Stann's not going anywhere either. Yes, he did get knocked out, but if we look at, okay, in the cage, you know, he brings it. Very aggressive style fighter, so that's always pleasing to the eyes of the Zuffa family. They want to see that go on. But then you also look at the backstory with him. He's a Marine, went to the Naval Academy. Obviously, he's won some medals while he was in the Marines. So he's a really good story as far as promoting the sport. You see him do some commentary when they have the UFC on Fox events. You'll see him being one of the analysts that sits at the desk with the Curt Menefee and Randy Couture, John Jones, whoever. So obviously he's placed as a major player in the UFC. So I don't think he's going anywhere. He shouldn't be cut or anything like that. But it obviously is a setback for his career because I think he's kind of reaching that level where he is not going to be a title contender as well. And speaking of a guy that may be a title contender, believe it or not, is Mark Hunt, who had that vicious knockout of Shroop in his fight on Saturday as well. Mark Hunt, interesting guy, fought in K1, kickboxer. Doesn't look like one of those guys that you look at. You look at his body type. It may look, I guess, pudgy is the nicest way to put it. But he doesn't look like the lean cut guys that you would think from a lot of MMA fighters. But he can punch, man. He is He's one of those guys where he takes a lot of punishment. It doesn't look like he's going to do anything. But he knocked the crap out of Shroot. That was impressive. And now he's won 4 fights in a row in the UFC. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do with him as far as how they have him fight. I saw the Dagomi Sanchez fight. Yeah, the judging was a little iffy. Welcome to watching combat sports. It's not going to be a full combat sport event if the judging isn't screwy. And that's another lecture for another day on how you can improve scoring. But that stuff's going to happen. I thought the Fuel card overall was solid. You're not obviously going to... You got a title fight actually a few weeks ago on the Fuel UFC on Fuel event. They had the, I think, the bantamweight title on the line. But you're not going to... Or a flyaway, one of them. But you're not going to see a lot of the major players fighting on Fuel. But hey, it's an MMA fight. I'm going to watch it. So I enjoyed seeing some of those fights as well. If you have any comments on it, on that fight, or just anything in general, please go to our website, sportsinquirer.net. You can also hit us up on Twitter. My, I guess, tag or screen name is Sports Inquirer. Also, we are on iTunes, so if you want to get these episodes automatically downloaded to your iTunes store, please subscribe to us. I'm under the Sports Inquirer, so there's many ways you can get in touch with me. So we're going to take a little bit of a break here right now, here on the Sports Inquirer Network, and I'm hitting on some miscellaneous loose ends from this weekend. It was a solid week of racing as well out there in the sports world this weekend. Yesterday, the NASCAR, they continued the series. It's funny, I want to call it the Winston Cup so bad. I know it's still, we're in got the Nationwide series and all that stuff, and we got the insurance companies running at the Nextel and all that. I'm an old school man. I want to go call it the Winston. I still remember the days of Dale Earnhardt and Darrell Waltrip and all of those guys, you know, putting in work in the Allisons and everything like that. That's when I started following the sport. And it was just the Winston Cup. That's what you called it. And I slipped up and I wanted to call it the Winston Cup there. So I was thinking, just going back to my childhood there. Carl Edwards finally broke his winless streak after 70 races. He got the victory, led the most laps throughout the race, and he pretty much dominated the contest from beginning to end. You kind of had a feeling that he'd be the main guy to get the victory. The thing about these NASCAR, at least the first few races, as far as when you get to the Cup Series and a major event, the first 4 or 5 races, you just don't want to have any DNFs or not finish. That's the biggest thing. You want to finish in the top 10 or 15. You want to get a few victories, of course, because that does help you to make the chase, because one of the biggest tiebreaker factors when you break it down is how many races you won, as far as how, if you can make the chase, even if you're not within the top 10 or 12. Point being, though, is you want to finish in the top 5 or 10. Make sure you pace yourself and make sure that you keep going. So Edwards getting that win is really good after he had that crash at Daytona and did not finish the race. So that's really good for him. Remember 2 years ago, him and Tony Stewart went down to the very last race to win the Cup. And Stewart ended up getting that victory. And last year was almost a lost year for Carl Edwards and what you expect from him. So it was nice to see him get that victory. You can sell the Daytona withdrawal or the hangover from that. It was really Daytona was exciting because you had Danica Patrick making a big run there. And it's Daytona. You know, that's all we all get excited about. Jimmy Johnson got the win, a familiar name, and everything like that. But and Danica, she cut her, I think, her either front or back right tire, and that she crashed and didn't finish the race. And Jimmy Johnson, he had a top five or top ten finish as well. But it's always interesting the week after, or first few weeks after Daytona, see how these teams go out. Because you look at the first race and you think, oh man, this you don't do well there, your season's over. There are so many races that have to take place before the championship, even before the chase. First goes to make the chase, and after that you want to win the championship. There's so much racing left that, from Clint Boyer, I thought that was really good. He had a mishap with the pit crew as far as how many tires he wanted to get. I think he wanted four, but they only did two, or two and four. There was a miscommunication. They messed that up. He lost a lot of places on the track because of that. He had a little bit of a blow up during the race, but he kept his composure and got a top 10 finish. And that's all you have to do if you want to be a title contender, is get those going. So Carlos got the win. That was good for him. Actually saw the Supercross race in St. Louis. Filippone got his fourth win of the season. He is slowly creeping up to Davey Millsaps. Davey Millsaps needs to be careful, because Millsaps jumped out to such a big lead in the overall point standings for Supercross, the 450s, and you're starting to see Filippone, the two-time defending champion, really make his presence felt. He got another victory, fourth win. That's the most out of everybody this season. So Millsaps, at first, he had like a 25, 26-point lead in the standings, which is pretty much a race. You win 25 points you get for first place in a race. So he pretty much had a one-race lead on Millsaps had on Villapono. But now, I think it's about 15 now, so he's slowly starting to chip away. So with the thing about Supercross, you have to qualify in the heat races just to make it to the main event. So if Millsaps one day, like next few races, has a mechanical error or can't make the final main event because he had an issue with the heats and couldn't make the race in the last chance qualifier, all Filippone has to do is get a win and he could be right there, maybe even take the lead overall in the standings. So that race is not over. I was happy to see James Stewart. As I said last week, he's my favorite racer. Motorcycle racer. He had the lead for a good amount of race, but he saw Filippone take over with about 10 laps to go and get that victory, and actually won by a few seconds. And Stewart seems like he's slowly getting his act together. He's coming off a lot of knee injuries, guys coming off. Filippone's coming off a knee surgery, and then Stewart's had some knee troubles as well. So you're seeing these guys trying to get grinded out and get some victories coming off of injury. So Stewart looks like the stamina is starting to get a little bit better, and he's not going to win a championship, but if he could finish, he could finish top four or five in overall standings by the end of the year. Saw some NHL as well. Blackhawks, they're still have not lost in regulation. Yesterday's game was ridiculous because they're down by one goal, minute left at Detroit. And you're thinking, all right, the streak is over. We're done here. All of a sudden, Patrick Kane gets the puck on the right side, shoots it, scores. We're going to overtime. Overtime, no score. And when I say they haven't lost in regulation, that's what the whole streak is about. They've lost games at overtime or after overtime finishes in the shootout, but they have not had a loss in regulation. So if you look at it kind of like in soccer term, or any other sport you may follow that does a point system, they really haven't dropped too many points. They haven't left a contest without a point. So that's how they got this point streak going. So it's not necessarily undefeated, like some people have been saying, because they have had some losses technically, but they haven't really dropped any. They've left every contest with at least one point. Anyway, so they finally get overtime, nothing happens. And then at the final shootout attempt, Kane does a really nifty wrist shot past Howard, and they get the victory. I don't know how long it's going to last, how long it's going to keep going. I mean, they may lose a game or two coming up, and they're going to lose. It's going to happen. They're not going to go the entire season undefeated. But I will say this, though. They're one of those teams. They're kind of similar to the Spurs when I was talking about earlier with San Antonio in the NBA, where they have two elite guys. They have Taze, and they have Kane, the Blackhawks. And Duncan Keith, I guess consider him an elite guy as well, and Crawford's an excellent goalkeeper. But they have a unit where they work a system, and they just keep coming in droves, and they keep flowing. You see the second and third lines play at the same level or just as hard as the first line, and they just have really good defensive principles, and that's where they've been. They did a really good breakdown after the first period of that contest, where you saw the defense principles, where the back checking was excellent. The neutral zone was kept under control. So it's not like they're just outscoring people and they don't play any defense. They play very good defense, and if you can do that, you're going to be consistently in a lot of contests. So they've kept it going. Anaheim and Vancouver are going to be a tough go for them in the postseason as far as the Western Conference. Eastern Conference, I caught the end of this game as well. I caught a lot of end of games this week. I don't know. I was just running around taking care of business. I like that road win by the Canadiens at Boston. Canadiens, similar to Toronto, they're marquee franchises, and you kind of wonder why they haven't done better than they have been. Toronto, that I think our Maple Leafs are going to be in trouble. They've had so many goaltending issues and injuries. They just need to make the postseason. That'd be a really good run for them. But Montreal, though, they might have a shot to make a run in that Eastern Conference, because I look at the other teams. Boston's good, and Pittsburgh, when you have Crosby and Malkin, and you have good goalkeeping, you're going to be around. Devils, kind of same thing. They're scoring by committee and got Brodeur. But if you look at Montreal, they have good scores. They have that Price, who's a really good goalkeeper. They're going to be right there in the end. And I just like that. I like when you win those gritty wins on the road against a rival team. Those are so important because they mean so much more and you get the points. But I think overall for them as a team, that was a really good win for them. And I think that's... Oh, and then also, really chippy game between Ottawa and New York. You know, you saw the Ottawa player, you know, board the New York Ranger. That was really ugly. You don't like to see that type of stuff. And I will say this, NHL, they're quick with their suspension, so we'll see what happens there. Once I find out what happens with that, I'll probably have some comments in the next podcast about what I think of that hit. But it happened over the weekend, so I got to mention that. So those are just some general things that I thought of. I'm going to take a little bit of a quick break here, go through one or two more observations from this weekend, and then we're going to go to the Ruffle of Feathers section here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. I got one last sports note. I was going to do some general things outside the world of sports. And man, for those of you that don't know as well, I follow the EPL a lot, and I really need to talk more about international soccer, and we'll get to a lot more of that stuff their season's towards ending. I mean, we're in March right now, and we're going to have a lot of international action as well, but my Gunners, Arsenal. If I said my Spurs, that's terrible. But the Spurs beat Arsenal 2-1 yesterday, and that was just a really disappointing loss for Arsenal. Who, if you're not going to make the Champions League, and it's going to be really difficult for them to make that now with that loss, if you're not going to make the Champions League or even contend for the millions of cups between the FA and Carling and the backyard trophy in England, you got to at least beat the rival. You got to beat Spurs. And they lost. They got two. I mean, Ben had outstanding goal. Lennon scored a goal. I mean, it was just like 2-0 within the first 20 minutes. And you're not going to win at White Hart Lane. you know, going behind 2-0 just like that. Even though Arsenal did have a lot of chances, they did get one goal, but that was disappointing. So, once again, as an Arsenal fan, I'm struggling right now because they're just in no man's land. They're kind of in the purgatory of European soccer, and if they don't even make the Champions League, that's a really bad setback. And Arsenal probably find a way to make it again, finish in fourth place and cash that check. But we've seen the past few weeks they lost. That Bayern loss was disappointing. This Tottenham loss. It's to the point where if they play a team equally or better, they're going to lose. They don't really have any upsets in them. And you got to beat teams equally or better than you sometimes if you want to make the equivalent of the postseason in European soccer, which is a Champions League. But anyway, that was my minute on European soccer there. As far as, I actually spent a lot of time Saturday watching movies. I got my Netflix account back up and running. And it's a movie I've been trying to check out for years and finally sat down and saw it. And that was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The movie with Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey and Kirsten Dunst and, you know, a lot of guys in that. That, for some reason, that was one of those movies that you heard so much about and Winslet won the Academy Award for it. But I just did not see it. And that was a mind trip. That was an outstanding movie. And there was a lot to it. A lot of heavy stuff. And this is based on a book, and I really would like to check out the book. I'm going to do the rarity of watching the movie and then reading the book. So after this podcast is over, I'm definitely going to do my Amazon search and see what's going on with that. But that movie was a really heavy movie. A lot with a breakdown of how your psychological mind and how our mind works and with our memories and how we try to repress memories and forget certain people in our lives. I don't want to give it away for the two of you listening to this that haven't seen the movie, you know, but I really recommend that you check that out. Also saw the documentary on CM Punk, some WWE action there. I really thought with the WWE documentaries, they go one or two directions. They'll go in one direction where they'll just show a bunch of old matches and they talk to nobody, not even the actual person that the documentary is about. Those I don't like. I go to YouTube and see all the old matches I want. And then you have the second one where they incorporate interviews with the wrestler or the talent and some of the family members and fellow competitors over the years. And that's when this one was more like that, the CM Punk documentary. You saw the old stuff with him wrestling in Chicago in the Midwest, and they go into Ring of Honor and WWE and ECW. I know none of y'all are wrestling fans, but different federations, and now he's arguably the biggest star in the sport. But it was really cool to see a guy that you remember seeing in different promotions back in the early 2000s and his rise to prominence now as a major player. And so I liked that they talked to his family. It was a really deep man. He talked about a lot of family issues. He went there as far as a relationship that he doesn't have with his family and relationship he has with his adopted family, even though he's not really adopted. It's really, as far as non-wrestling fans, I really recommend that you see it because you get to see an in-depth look at an athlete. I know wrestling is a sport to me. It's still real to me. And, you know, but it's good to see kind of the perspective of a man and how he goes about the path of reaching the peak of his profession. It was very inspiring to see that and his loyalty towards his friends, who he considers family, and just his definition of what family is. And obviously you get, and for all the wrestling geeks out there, you get to see him win the championships and talks about some of the feuds he had, and you get to see some of the actual in-ring action of that stuff. But I thought it was done really well. You also saw some current video, and they spliced that in there. He's from Chicago, so you saw a lot of Chicago footage. You saw how he became a vegetarian and how he changed his body and his lifestyle as far as that goes. They talk a lot about how he's someone that's a straight edge, which is someone who does not partake in drinking alcohol or smoking or doing drugs, and just the definition of straight edge and how he applies that to his life. It's really interesting because, you know, someone that does not live that way, if you do or you don't, just seeing how someone incorporates that into their lifestyle and totally commits to it, I thought that was really good, you know, as well. And he has a lot of tattoos. He talked about those as well. Really great documentary is what I'm trying to say. Even if you're not a wrestling fan, look it up on Netflix, CM Punk, WWE. I recommend that you give that a check out. So I spent a lot of time catching up on some movies and some other fun activities there. We're going to wrap up the podcast right now with things that ruffled my feathers, and we're going to go to our man, Dennis Rodman. Usually on Sunday mornings, I wake up, I make some breakfast, try to catch up on the McLaughlin Report, watch some SportsCenter, maybe do some writing, some reading, play with the cat, just some general things that any man would do. One thing I do like to do as well is watch the political shows. You got CBS This Morning, they got their version Sunday morning. You've got Fox, they have their stuff. I'm partial to the McLaughlin Report. I'm an old school man, watched that as a kid, still represent for John McLaughlin, all of that stuff. So why is it that when on Sunday morning I turn on the TV and ABC and I see George Stephanopoulos, he's doing his thing with, I guess, ABC This Week, and I see Dennis Rodman? Now, I'm thinking maybe he's doing some talk about, you know, maybe he's had some ups and downs professionally and personally he's on the new Celebrity Apprentice. I thought maybe they're promoting that. Well, then why would you have him on Sunday morning on that type of show? Why not Good Morning America? Or Regis and Kelly or Mike and Kelly or whatever. Or The View. Why is he on my Sunday commentary show with George Stephanopoulos? Well, it looks like our man Dennis Rodman went over to North Korea and is apparently friends with the dictator and the son of Kim Jong-il. Now, last week on our podcast, we talked about our professional athletes, especially black athletes, since it was the end of Black History Month, and their presence and political issues, and how we had Muhammad Ali's and Jim Brown's of the past making political statements about what was going on for black people at you know, during their time in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and how the current athletes really don't do that as much, and they worry about endorsements or where their place is within society. Well, our boy Dennis is not concerned about that. Not only is he not concerned about endorsements or deals, he sounded like he was actually advocating North Korea. Now, not to get political about where I'm a leftist or rightist, or if I believe in Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian, Independent, whatever, I think we can all agree that things going on in North Korea are not good. And Dennis Rodman is an American. And while I appreciate one side of it, he's an American, he has a right to his own opinions and right freedom of speech. I'm a very big advocate of that. But when you're advocating what's going on in North Korea and making it seem like, oh, I was just over there with a friend hanging out, we're just going to go play. And, you know, oh, like, he wants to speak to President Obama like he has, like, they're buddies. And that was nothing with Dennis Rodman saying, like, the dictator's son just wants President Obama to call him because they don't want war. Well, I don't want a lot of stuff myself. I don't like rain. I don't like dogs sometimes. I don't want war either. But you're not going to see me call up the most notorious dictatorship in the world and say, hey, let's talk. Let's not have war. Now, I think the comedic aspect of this is off the chain because, or off the wall, because we could have Dennis Rodman serve as a peacemaker. Don't worry about nuclear war. Don't worry about the test of the bombs. Don't worry about the Communist Party over there and the millions of people living in adverse conditions. Dennis Rodman's going to go over there and lead them to freedom and serve as a peacemaker. He's going to be our modern-day Jimmy Carter or Jesse Jackson and bring peace to everybody. Dennis Rodman is going to show them a few tips of how to rebound. He's going to show them some fashion tips, where to party, and just some other fun activities. So it's always funny when you see the political world cross over in the sports world in that way. And I have to give kudos to it, because while it actually wasn't as worse of an interview, as bad as an interview as it was, because Dennis Rodman made sense in a way. If you looked at it in a vacuum, if you forgot that it was North Korea and United States relations and all things going on over there, you'll say to yourself, you know what, Dennis is right. We should go over there and become friends. And he's just like an average guy, and like everything is okay. But obviously we know that it's not. But hey, bless his heart, he has made his statement. And don't be surprised if in a few years we actually have a North Korean United States basketball game and Dennis Rodman is starting at power forward. So those are my thoughts on Sports World over this past weekend. Thanks for listening to Sports Inquirer podcast. We are available on thesportsinquirer.net. You can subscribe to us on iTunes under the Sports Inquirer. Send me an email anytime at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. And we're on Twitter as well under Sports Inquirer. Next show, I'm going to have Condor Addison back. We're going to discuss some NFL notes and other things going on in the world of sports. Until then, good fight, good night.